yes, please stay here. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Unless you can also spread over the room so that you are more forceful then. No, it's up to you where you want to sit. Is anybody missing here now? Oh yeah, no, please sit here. No, it's. I just thought that the two of you should perhaps agree on. Okay, good afternoon and welcome to the UK Country Best Practice Forum, Partnerships in Practice. This forum is a new format. We haven't done that last year in Athens, and the idea is to give countries and organizations the opportunity to present specific initiatives and to give others the opportunity to learn from that. This forum will now consist of, that's what I thought, two parts. One deals with the regulatory environment, particularly the relationship between private sector and the government in UK. And the second one deals with the attempt to build a local IGF, or if you want, a national IGF. Both parts will be illustrated by case studies. We have in the first part the regulatory environment, a case study on Nominet, and we have also a case study on the London Internet Exchange, which has been a model for other internet exchanges worldwide. And the second one, the second part has case studies as well, and I will talk about those later. I first introduce the panel. We have Martin Boyle from the Department for Business, who will talk about the regulatory environment from a government perspective. We have Emily Taylor from Nominet, who will introduce Nominet. And we have Malcolm Hutty from the London Internet Exchange. And we have also discussions. Dr. Jeremy Beale from the Confederation of British Industry, and we have Alun Michael, a member of the British Parliament, and which is still difficult for me because I'm new to this environment. RT stands for Right Honourable, an institution we don't know. I just moved to London, so for me it's also a good opportunity to get familiar with English rituals and practices and to get to know you a bit better. So I guess we start with Martin Boyle, who talks about the regulatory environment. Please, you are.
Thanks very much, Jeanette, and Alan can sort you out later on the difference between English and Welsh. I always feel a little bit of a fraud taking the floor to talk about something that is essentially a very lightweight model where the government sees its role very much more as an enabling role. And I see that actually I've been moved straight onto my first content slide, so that perhaps is suggesting that I ought to make the full use of my 5 minutes to talk about the very lightweight structure that we have. But I think what I'd like to do is start off on what is the government actually interested in achieving? Because the underlying issue is not the internet per se, but rather the fact that the internet is an enabler of a modern economy. And therefore, the first of these bullets, the UK as one of the best places in the world to do e-business, is actually quite fundamental. And therefore, what we're actually looking at doing is trying to ensure that we have got the world-class infrastructure that a modern economy needs to achieve that goal. The internet as a source of the innovation and business that is going to be the wealth creation for us. And the other point that perhaps is worthwhile mentioning in this sort of introductory bit is that we're looking at, and we heard this in the critical internet resources session, one infrastructure. And that infrastructure needs a certain amount of investment, you can deal with that by the government funding all of infrastructure development, but then it has to sit with all the other priorities that a government might have, including transport and energy and water. In the UK model, we have seen the separation and the encouragement of investment in that infrastructure by the private sector in the internet, in transport, in energy, and in water. Can we go to the next slide, please? And one of the problems of actually having slides behind you and you can't see them. Fortunately, I printed them out, so I do actually know what I said. So as I say, the regulatory environment that we're looking at is all a matter about how do we promote that environment for investment. And I think the basic rule of any regulatory environment is that it should be pro-competitive and it should be predictable. And that then leads you to the, well, okay, the internet is something relatively new. More importantly, it's actually something that's changing very, very quickly. And that gives you a bit of a quandary about trying to work out how you might, if you were to decide you need to regulate, where would you fit the internet? And I think if you were to say, well, we have regulators for broadcasting, we have regulators for telecommunications, where would you sit it? And inevitably, if you decide to regulate the internet as a telecoms infrastructure, you will have one set of influences on your growth and your development of the infrastructure, which is not necessarily what you would wish to achieve. In the same way as if you treat it as a broadcasting medium, you're actually making something that influences the way things happen. And that led to, going back to 2003, the passing of the Communications Act, which led to the creation of a converged regulator, the creation of Ofcom. And Ofcom actually moved to the next step, which is their basic presumption is not to regulate. You actually have to have a good reason as to why you should be regulating. In other words, there needs to be some distortion. The pro-competitive market is the pro-competitive environment is not working, that there should therefore you're looking for trying to correct the fact that you have got barriers. The second bit is this competitive environment in a wider sense. And of course, the internet is working in an environment, in an economy. It is generally quite competitive. And if there are anti-competitive actions that happen, there are actually competition regulators that look at general issues. And the third issue is the industry role and the industry taking its own responsibility for ensuring that it provides a safe environment. I see Jeanette's getting agitated, so I'll speed up for the what are the issues. And I think this really just falls out very easily from my earlier comments. I think one of the concerns that we always have is that you treat the internet as different and you try to resolve those issues on the internet that you have never ever been able to resolve in the real world. Somehow or other, we've never ever managed by passing laws, and Alan Michael's got an excellent quotation that I won't take from him about this, that you can pass a law, but inevitably, people break the law. and therefore, just deciding that you can make the internet that perfect, safe, secure place is going to do two things. It's going to make it more difficult to build up your internet activities. Secondly, it's actually not going to sort out the problems that you thought you were going to deal with. So you've actually hit yourself twice. Protecting the vulnerable. This is actually something that inevitably underpins all thoughts about the legislator and the parliamentarian. And in the late summer, the Prime Minister made a specific announcement about protecting children from undesirable content. And we have established a review, the government has established a review led by Dr. Byron and Dr. Tanya Byron, and she will be looking at and talking to stakeholders about what can be done to address these issues. The last point on the slide is cryptically innovation or prediction. And I think one of the problems we actually have is that we try to look forward and say, what is going to happen? And I'm actually reminded that in 1998, I was secretary to a foresight panel that had the embarrassment of not having predicted the internet. Not only that, if you then took what the foresight panel said in 1998 and subsequently, what actually happened after that was in fact entirely unpredictable. And as soon as you start deciding how people should start sorting things out, then you start constraining the innovation and the wealth creation that you can build on. That allows me to go straight through the next slide on the future about let's predict it. The only other example I would choose is that 10 years ago, the OECD did an Ottawa ministerial conference on e-commerce, and there was no mention of the internet in 1998 looking at e-commerce. I hope they're a little bit more effective and efficient when we have ministers together in June next year to look at the new applications, the way the internet is changing, and the challenges that are going to hit us from there. And I think that certainly exceeds my 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Martin. I think we go now straight to our two case studies, starting with Links and then Nominet. If you can, I think it would be interesting for the audience if you also could point out relationships you have to the Department of Business and how they are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Malcolm Hutty, and I'm from Links, the London Internet Exchange. I'll address the relations with the Department for Business through the course, is the few words I'm going to say to describe us, if I may. Links is a mutual association of networks, principally internet service providers, that have come together to facilitate the interconnection of internet traffic within the UK. When we draw pictures of how the internet works, we often draw pictures of a computer in somebody's home and a computer in somebody else's home, and things like emails and web pages going up the wires and disappearing into a fluffy cloud in the middle that we label the internet. Now, that fluffy cloud is a representation of how difficult it can sometimes be to describe exactly what's going on there in the middle. But if you think about it, emails don't actually travel over fluffy clouds. They have to travel over wires or over wireless connections or some form of technical means to ensure the transmission of information. And in practice, this means that if you're sending an email from one ISP to another, those ISPs have to be linked together. In short, somewhere there is a wire from one internet service provider that is connected to a wire that belongs to the other internet service provider, and that provides the opportunity to pass data between them. This can happen directly or indirectly, but ultimately the wires touch. They have to. It's physics. Our function is to be the place where they touch. Our members, the internet service providers, come along and plug their wires into a box that we operate. There's more than one box. That's an oversimplification. But essentially, one comes along with a wire and plugs it into our box. Another one comes along with a wire and also plugs it into our box. And that way, there is interconnection. And that is just simply the function, the very limited function that we perform. But it does enable traffic to flow. Lynx today is quite a large organization. We've got over 250 member networks, mainly ISPs, a few content businesses, a few large content businesses, so Google's a member and the BBC's a member and a few more like them, but generally speaking, the internet service providers. We are passing nearly 200 gigabits per second on our public exchange, which by anybody's standard is an awful lot of data. In addition to that, there is over 80 gigabits per second of traffic that passes through private peering that we facilitate. That's not on the box that we operate or the little series of boxes, but that is facilitated interconnection between our members that we organize. And if you come and join the links, if you are operating a network and you come and join the links and plug yourself into our box, you can connect to any of the other members that plug into that box too. So this is a very efficient way of providing for interconnection. And because Lynx is so big, more than 50% of the entire routing table, that's 50% of the internet you could reach without paying for it, just by forming agreements with other Lynx members by interconnecting at the Lynx. We're far from the only internet exchange point. And there are some other very big ones, particularly AMZIX. In Amsterdam, and a number of others. But Lynx is one of the larger ones that provides this level of interconnection. Now, interconnection has been a topic that's been debated in quite a lively fashion through the access track at the IGF, and is debated in quite a lively fashion in study group 2 and study group 3 at the ITU. And a lot of that is about how do developing countries get the benefits of this interconnection when they have to pay for the traffic, they have to pay to get access to the internet, whereas rich developed countries like the United States and Europe don't have to pay. Well, the reason why I'm here is because of the historical approach that we can show, because Lynx hasn't always been that big. We were founded back in 1994. In 1994, most internet network traffic, most traffic passing between ISPs in the UK, went via New York. Each ISP had to pay for a connection to New York, send the traffic off to New York, and it connected in New York and then came back again to reach another UK network, which was very expensive, it's slower and inefficient, and it creates an unnecessarily opportunity for failure, the transatlantic link there, and everything's flowing over the transatlantic link. This is seen as being clearly very far short of being ideal. Those of you who have been paying close attention to the discussions on international interconnection in the access track and in the ITU study groups will, I'm sure, see the parallel here between the same comments that are being made by other countries that have not developed their internet as early as the United Kingdom was able to do so. A very similar situation we experienced just a little earlier. So how do we deal with that? Well, seven British ISPs came together to form Lynx to help keep the local traffic local. Importantly, there was no government involvement in this whatsoever. Now, I don't want to say that we don't have good and friendly relations with the Department for Business. Of course we do nowadays. But that wasn't how it got started. We didn't start with a directive from government. We started with seven ISPs foreseeing that it was in their own interest to interconnect, to reduce the costs, and to increase the technical efficiency. Now, of course, when seven competitors come together and seek to cooperate, there are concerns about whether one might do the others over, whether they can really be trust each other. So they founded Lynx as a neutral vehicle, neutral between members, not favoring any one commercial entity over another, and also neutral in the sense of not being a strategic competitor to with them. They can join us without fear that we will subsequently be trying to win their business or take over their business. We are not an internet service provider. As a result of founding the Lynx, we had enormous progress in keeping local traffic local, and that's how we ascend to the sort of the enormous traffic volumes that we're talking about nowadays. This led to cheaper connectivity, which drove demand and broadened participation, so far more people were able to afford to join the internet. And this led to an increasingly virtuous circle of competition, cost reduction, service improvement, additional demand, and therefore it all becomes cheaper again, and the cycle repeats. So it has been effective for everyone. The last slide that I have, because I can see that I need to round up. A few points that we've learnt over the time of having done this. From a public policy perspective, we believe that exchanges flourish in a pro-competitive environment. Now, I don't like to talk about the details of competition policy because we are neutral between our members, and our members have slightly different views on precisely what needs to be done in order to achieve that. But I don't think there is anybody amongst our membership that doesn't believe that a pro-competitive environment generally is a good thing. None of the members connecting at Lynx, if you believe in that form of interconnection, believes in the holy monopoly model of you're not allowed to exchange traffic. We've also found that the voluntary approach, the self-seeking approach, if you like, is the most sustainable one. Don't force people to do it. Let them see that it is in their own benefit. For ISPs, for our member networks, don't be afraid. Join in. You won't be forced to do anything that you don't want to. You've got everything to gain. For the exchange itself, there have been some interesting learning points as well, and points that I would like to be discussed with those that are founding, operating, or thinking of founding internet exchanges in other countries for the first time. The first point is that neutrality between the members is essential. Trust is everything if you're seeking to get competitors to cooperate, and that means neutrality of the exchange. We found that it's best to keep the exchange open to everyone. Anyone can join it. We found that by trying the opposite first and finding it didn't work. Originally, we thought that the best thing to do was to keep the exchange closed to only those that had the international interconnection transit. And then we thought, but then more people wanted to join, and the existing members wanted to peer with them, so they let a few in, but wanted to keep it just to those that had met a definition of ISP. And then people wanted to peer with people like the BBC and latterly Google. So ultimately we ended up discovering, through a process of error, that keeping the exchange open to everyone is the right policy. But keeping the exchange open to everyone is only sustainable if peering is voluntary, if the interconnection is voluntary. Just because you join the exchange doesn't mean you have to interconnect with any particular person at the exchange. You can interconnect with whoever you like. If you don't have that policy, if you try and make everybody at the exchange interconnect with everybody else by force, then they will try to exclude people as the result of that. Then the members of the exchange will try to exclude others from being able to join the exchange. So by having voluntary peering, you can maximize the opportunity for everybody. And the final point that we've learned for ourselves is to know our limits, to promote cooperation between our members, but don't try to force people. Don't try to control the member networks. That's not the role of an internet exchange. Ours is a facilitating role. We shouldn't be trying to run the networks for our members. We shouldn't be trying to implement or to force on a public policy of any kind. We are there to facilitate interconnection, and I think we're doing not a bad job.
Thank you, Malcolm. This was very interesting. So we hand over the floor to Emily.
It's always a relief when the right presentation comes up. Thank you very much, Malcolm and Jeanette. What I'd like to cover in this brief outline, we're sort of crossing over into the next phase of this workshop. What I'd like to start off with is introducing you to Nominet, which is the .uk registry. And then over the latter part of the presentation, to talk about the steps that we've been taking recently, which Leslie referred to and Alan Michael referred to in the Critical Internet Resources panel just now, to try and create a UK internet governance process, and to report back to you about the messages that UK stakeholders gave us for this meeting, and then to dwell a little while on our competition to find examples of best practice in the four IGF themes which we held in the UK. So, Nominet, what are we? We're a not-for-profit company, a bit like the Lynx, and like the Lynx, we are industry self-organised. Like the Lynx, we've also seen huge changes in scale over the last 11 years of our existence. We started with 100 members. We could comfortably get them all into the same room. We knew most of them, and we could talk to them quite easily. You fast forward 11 years, and there are nearly 3,000 members, thanks to very low barriers to becoming a member and registrar. As a result, there is very, very strong registrar competition. Now, this is, of course, not unique to the UK. There are other examples within Europe and internationally. But we think that the key elements that have driven the growth in the UK are an open membership model, liberal domain name policies, and active interaction and participation with the wider stakeholder community. So this is not quite the standard private company that you're seeing. We have a range of stakeholders because as we have defined the mission, we are here not just for our members, although they are of key importance, of course, but also for all of those who rely on the proper functioning of the domain name system, both nationally, whether they be parliamentarians, government, big and small businesses, those more directly involved in the domain name system, registrants and registrars. And then there are the sort of the issues that arise from naming: privacy, data protection, the conflict between intellectual property rights holders and domain names. And of course, importantly, there is our staff. And also relevantly to our discussions today is the interaction and the learnings that we have from the international community. But as was mentioned in the last plenary, one of the key elements that makes a country code registry like Nominet different from a generic registry is the local determination of policy. So how is that done? Well, it's done through a lot of consultation, consensus building, and direct dialogue with the people involved. So who will change from issue to issue? So for example, we were talking recently about trying to respond to phishing, which is a growing scene in the UK as internationally. So we were talking for the first time with the financial institutions and with APACs. But examples of policies that we've formulated, you can see on the list here. Who is, dispute resolution, and actually the registration policy itself, which is very fundamental. The idea that it is first come, first served. If it's available, you can have it. Now, the next two slides look at our evolution over time and try to find out whether there is any price sensitivity in domain name registration. And I think we can say that there is price sensitivity. So what you see on this slide, there's a white line there, which shows the incremental reductions in price that have happened since our foundation. And you can see that most of that happened in the first 3 years of our existence. It started off, I think it was £100 to register. That very quickly moved down to 60, then 40, then 20, then £5, which was the big jump. And that was in 1999. Now, I'm not saying that the price reduction itself was the only element that led to the explosion of growth that we saw. This was, of course, the heady days of what's called the dot-com boom, which we always get upset about because we thought it was the .uk boom. But then I think what we did see was an exponential rise. When you go and look at the wider environment, it's quite interesting to see that in the early days of our existence, the economy, the performance of the Financial Times top 100 companies is pretty much independent of our own, going from 96 to 99. And then something strange happens. And with the price reduction, you see quite a correlation. I don't know what the links are. I don't know whether it's a coincidence. But it, to me, it looks pretty striking that that once the price got down to a critical point, you could see, in combination with other liberal policies, that the growth of this domain was free and tracks the performance of the economy. Interestingly, we're just seeing a slight downturn. So, moving on to the next phase, I'd like to talk to you about the steps that we took to prepare for this meeting in Rio. And what we wanted to do was to respect paragraph 80 of the Tunis Agenda and try to create a process, a meaningful process at the national level to support the international dialogue. Well, of course, learning from the Internet Governance Forum itself, that would have to be multi-stakeholder. And in fact, with our history, it's pretty unthinkable that it could be anything else. And we were very pleased that we had the support of key parliamentarians, Alan Michael, and the Department for Business. We've held a number of preparatory meetings, and this year, the sort of key element of our preparations was the Best Practice Challenge. So, looking first, we held a meeting last month, which was attended by about 100 people, and again, multi-stakeholders, so from the full range. And we asked them to give us messages in these four core themes. The first thing that was very striking when we broke out into four different groups was that everybody nearly went into one of those workshops. They couldn't actually get through the door. And that was standing room only. I can remember actually pushing Zoe through the door to get her in. But not surprisingly, as a result of that, security was identified as the key issue, the key Internet Governance Forum issue for the UK stakeholders when they looked in the context of the national scene. Looking internationally, we asked our attendees to tell us what they thought was the most important IGF theme for the global development of the internet, and they told us again strongly, this is access. This is getting the next billion and the next billion after that online. We asked them to consider three questions. What challenges are facing us today here in the UK or there in the UK? And of our experiences, what do we think are relevant to share with an international audience? And also, in each of these four topics, what would be a good outcome, what would be a poor outcome from the IGF? Now, in this handout, which I hope you've got, this details theme by theme the way that people responded, and I'm not going to go through that in detail. But what I thought I'd draw out is some common themes. Partnership comes up again and again throughout these four themes. People are talking about the importance of working together across the traditional stakeholder barriers. The internet's too big for any one actor, for any one individual to cope with. So we also need to focus not purely on the negative. We often get caught up with the negative in these sort of discussions, but to think about positive examples, best practices, which can help us to learn as well. Also, not surprisingly, I think this echoes a lot of the dialogue, both in Athens and starting this year, the four themes interlock they overlap, they relate to each other. You can't really talk about access without thinking also about diversity. And so the issues all overlap, and it isn't just about technology, it's about people. It's about the way that the internet is affecting our society, the structures, and the way that we respond to things. Trust came up as a very important factor, whether that be in relation to the protection of vulnerable people or in relation to being able to trust that you can perform financial transactions online and buy stuff and know that you're not going to be ripped off. So, and then finally, the difficult tensions that we see repeated in our dialogue here, how you balance freedoms with senses of responsibility, and the uneasy tensions that coexist in this space. People wanted to share the idea of delivering access through remote learning. That was a very strong theme that came through as some of the examples in the Best Practice Challenge. And the idea that the internet can help minority communities, local language communities, to come online. It can also be a real engine to democratize and to champion freedom of expression. So what do people want from the IGF? Well, they liked multi-stakeholderism, best practice sharing, empowerment of communities through learning or through interaction here to build their own, to go and develop the internet in the innovative way that we've seen, and support for issues like multilingualism, freedom of expression, and universal access. There was quite a lot of fear looking at the other side of what, you know, what would be a poor outcome from the IGF. A lot of fear of some sort of takeover from the UN or top-down regulation that we saw, again, echoed across these four completely separate workshops. And also a fear that we would just concentrate on negatives, that we would just get bogged down in detail about who controls the web or other single issues and lose sight of the bigger picture. Now, finally, I'd like to just talk about our best practice challenge and why we did it, and what we've learned as a result. We've been actually promoting best practice as something that the IGF should be doing more of, because we've learned a lot from our colleagues internationally through dialogue and through just trying to explore what everyone's doing at the moment and how we're all trying to cope with the challenges. But we also noted that only 13% of attendees at Athens were from business, and we thought that there were a lot of examples at home that could possibly be showcased in Rio without having people have to travel. And we also wanted to use this as a linchpin for a UK process. So this is the shortlist of organisations in the access category. Now, these are outlined more in a wonderful brochure which is currently being held by the Brazilian Customs, but I am assured will arrive at some point and will be available on our stand. And this goes through each of the shortlisted entries in detail. I'm not proposing to do that now, but just to pick out a couple of examples. So Act Now was a project, a multi-stakeholder project, to bring broadband connection to a rural area in the west of England, Cornwall. It's incredibly successful, and as a result of it, Cornwall farmers have more connective, better broadband penetration than anywhere else in the country. But it also showed us there is the access, which is viewed as a developing country issue, is not only found in large countries like the US, not only found in developing countries. In a country, tiny little country like the UK, we've still got problems of getting rural communities online. And the other example I wanted to bring out is Penpole School, which it got a special commendation from the judges. This was a project to allow a small child who is very deeply disabled to attend school remotely through video conferencing, and they attached cameras to the kids and let them run about so he could see and experience school remotely. Now, the runner-up in this category was the RNIB, the Royal National Institute for the Blind, for their fabulous work in access, as in accessibility. And the winner was Computer Aid International. This is an organisation that refurbishes unwanted computers from the UK and brings them into the developed world. But as well as that, they also combine with a series of training activities and so on, and really provide an integrated approach. In security, there was a very strong child protection element, and in fact, this came through in all of the categories. One element to bring out here was Bebo. I mean, everybody in the UK is talking about user-generated content and social networking sites. Bebo, the runner-up, was an example of integrating user control over their own safety right into the heart of their offering. And the winner was Netcraft, which has a free anti-phishing toolbar. So just running through the other categories in brief, diversity, we saw examples of promoting Welsh language content, and the winner who's here today is ChildNet, which produced materials to help parents of children to cope with internet safety. On openness, we saw Amnesty, who are here at the IGF this year, and the winner was My Society, who have a whole series of sites to bring people closer to parliamentarians. And a special award for multi-stakeholder cooperation was given jointly to Internet Watch Foundation, who are here today, and to the Child and Exploitation Online Protection Centre, both of which show multi-stakeholder cooperation in the field of child protection. So lastly, we learnt a lot from operating the challenge. We actually designed it for business, but in fact what we found was that we had a huge response from civil society. Again, echoing the thoughts of those who took part in our workshops, there was a massive overlap in the entries. I mean, any one of them could probably go in openness, diversity, or access, with security sort of standing alone. We learned, perhaps surprisingly, that there's a digital divide in the UK, and also that there are relevant experiences, very strong child protection credentials, and multi-stakeholder partnerships. So thank you.
Thank you, Emily, for this very lively presentation. Before I ask our two discussants to comment, I would like to ask the audience whether there are any factual questions that we should first answer. Okay, then perhaps, Ellen Michael, you want to start?
Well, thanks very much. I'm going to stand up so I can twitch a bit, and there aren't any slides, so I need to be the visual bit. Sorry?
No, there aren't, I tell you.
I promise you. It's not that dangerous. Can I say I chaired the panel of judges for the Best Practice Awards, and it was extremely exciting as well as extremely challenging. And I think there were many, many more examples that could have come forward that weren't actually in the running because applications didn't come in. And it does demonstrate just how vibrant and lively this whole area is. I think we've got two good examples of a different way of doing things from both Nominet and Lynx. And they're ways that are innovative, they're effective, they work as intended. And I suppose the big question, which is quite a difficult one for us, Martin, is what can we learn about those, about how to fulfill the responsibilities of government? I mean, that's what we've been talking about in this afternoon session, is how the responsibilities of government or the responsibilities of international government or the responsibilities to people, individuals, communities, the excluded, can be delivered. And that's why there's a wrestling match over should it be left to ICANN or should things be done in a different type of way. And I think the problem is that government doesn't work as intended. That's why we're struggling with the work of government now, with things like transformational government, the attempt to open up more partnerships. And the attempt that's always made is to legislate, to forbid whatever the problem is. So you start off very often in government identifying a problem, then trying to tell people not to do whatever it is, or trying to prevent whatever it is that you don't like. And that is why the quote that Martin referred to earlier is one that I think is something that ought to be imprinted across the eyes of every member of parliament and every member of government, and that is that laws rarely prevent what they forbid. In my view, this can be a salutary thing to learn, and you can start in a different way. Can I just say, it doesn't just apply to the internet-related issues, by the way. I came to this view through dealing things like the Gangmasters Act about people trafficking and the REACH proposals, the proposals on how to deal with the control of man-made chemicals. And that was, if you start off, this may sound revolutionary, by understanding the problem, and by understanding the problem not by looking at the presenting problem, but doing it with all stakeholders and trying to build a consensus about the nature of the problem and the action that's going to deal with it, you may actually design something that would work. Even better, because that's a way of designing good legislation, what about doing it without legislation? Now, that's right in principle, but it's also, in relation to the internet, it seems to me, absolutely essential, because the speed of change is such that our methods of dealing with legislation and regulation just can't cope with keeping up with the speed. So it's not only right in principle, it's also essential that we adopt this now as a philosophic underpinning of the approach to dealing with the responsibilities of government, that they can only be fulfilled by being done in partnership, particularly with industry and depending on the expertise of industry, and saying basically to industry, wouldn't it be a good idea, instead of us legislating, that we agree what needs doing, you do it and we'll provide the context and the accountability systems which frees you to do it without the accusation that it is self-regulation. I have to tell you, I don't like the term self-regulation. What that means is, to me, is stuff like the Press Complaints Commission, which is totally useless, can't last much longer, because it doesn't regulate anything, and the evils that it's there to prevent just carry on without any regard being paid by any of the significant offenders. So it's useless as a way of doing things. So let's not talk about self-regulation, please. Let's talk. John challenged me on the point of co-regulation, because he pointed out that in Europe it's used as defining a system where there is legislative underpinning for joint regulation. So I'll have to use some different term. Cooperative regulation, perhaps, might be the term that I'd like to get away with, of saying you create an environment which has a minimum of legislation and regulation, which is flexible, which is industry-led, which is transparent and accountable, which to my mind, and this was the recommendations that we put forward not only for the composition of the Internet Governance Forum, but also for the management of a complaint centre approach for all crime and nuisance on the internet. By the way, that's not taking on responsibility for all crime, nor is it saying that there is crime which is specifically internet related. It's saying where criminal activity and nuisance is related to the internet, it needs to be dealt with coherently, because this is not now such a big part of our life. And you make the accountability very clear to four partners. That's government. Of course, government has to be there and involved. They're the people elected by the people. Parliament, because that makes it cross-party, which is an essential element, and I think that's even more essential when you look at the international dimension. Civil society, the NGOs, because, for instance, on issues of child protection, they have driven the engagement with child protection. And finally, industry as the major player, which is given authority to deal with the issues, if you like authority to self-regulation, but I don't like that way of describing it, by the engagement of the other players and a system of accountability. So we've had the example with child abuse, and when I undertook the review from a government perspective as a minister from Trade and Industry with my colleague from the Home Office, the conclusion we reached was we've achieved more in 2 years without regulation, without legislation, than we could have achieved in 10 years with legislation, with regulation. Why? Because it was the industry engaging voluntarily with the preoccupation of the NGOs, with government engagement, with a lot of input and pressure from parliamentarians as well, and that four-part partnership actually works. So it's right in principle. So the deal is partnership which provides accountability, a cooperative approach to regulation, and it fits well with the success that's been demonstrated by our two examples of creating an environment in which we do the things that government has to do, but we do it together instead of doing it in the old-fashioned way.
Thank you very much, Alan. And I think now Jeremy also wants to comment.
Thank you. I don't know whether to stand up or sit down after Alan's bravado.
Actually, I wonder what you could add. It seems that everybody is so much of the same opinion on this.
I think I'll wait to stand up until I have a drink. So it's been a long day. I will try and be brief because I realize that people probably need some refreshment after this long day. I've got three, maybe four points really to make. Firstly, the business community in the UK, and I speak not just in terms of the industry, i.e. the ISP community and the ICT industry, but business in general has appreciated and likes the regulatory environment or the light touch regulatory environment we have in the UK. It has allowed British business to be innovative, to create new services. There has been a significant growth, continuous growth, in e-commerce in the UK for the last 10 years or so. There have been dips over that period, but it has been a significant development of new services. And the regulatory regime has allowed that innovation, service innovation, to occur, and that is vital for British industry and British business in general, precisely because the UK is in a competitive international environment. They're facing increasing competitive challenge from low-cost countries overseas, as well as an intensification of competition in general from their people in the UK, other businesses in the UK and elsewhere, because of what the internet facilitates. Secondarily, though, they have realized that just as they face new challenges in this new environment, that new challenges are thrown up in a social sense, and they have appreciated the way that the regulatory environment that is in place, that Emily had talked about in particular, has been innovative in terms of the responses that it's allowed to those social challenges. If you look at paedophile websites, for instance, it has gone down from a large number, I can't remember how many years ago it was, when it was something like 17%, and it's now gone down to about 2%. And that was because of a cooperative effort, a voluntary cooperative effort on the part of ISPs and others to deal with that problem. It wasn't something legislated by government. So business appreciates that they get something, but they also have to support an environment where other people can get involved. And I think this underlines the point that was made about as long as the system that is put in place is participatory and allows that flexibility of actors, doesn't overspecify what the obligations and responsibilities are of people, they can identify their responsibilities and be responsible. The third point I have to make, though, is that I don't know if we're not reaching a sort of end point in this game, in the sense that the challenges that British businesses face are increasingly not necessarily met by the existing structure. We shall have to see, in that both Emily and Malcolm talked very much about bringing costs down, and that allowed this sort of wave of innovation to occur. People who had never done things before were able to do it. But increasingly, the challenge that British business face is adding value. It's not just getting your costs down vis-a-vis the competition you're facing. It's being able to, on that innovation that occurs there, to build higher value services that you can offer to your customers so that you can make sure that they are more loyal to you than they're going to be to a competitor. And you can only do that in a highly diverse system. But we shall have to see whether the system, the regulatory system in the UK and the institutions that have grown up about that, around that, are able to respond in some way to help businesses build that value. And this brings me to what is sort of the fourth point, because it's the debate that we've been having here, which is that, one, are there lessons from the experiences of the UK that developing countries and other countries can take for themselves, or is it just the, you know, UK experience because the UK has a unique position in the international economy, or is there something that can be taken away? And secondarily, is there something in the environment that is going to be a driver of those change? And I'll address the last one, which is more speculative. I do think that the existing system of domain name allocation and of traffic peering was particularly suitable for an IPv4 environment. I think IPv6 will throw up a lot more challenges, but also provide a lot more capabilities to use the internet. And we were at one of the breakout sessions earlier this afternoon where, you know, some of the difficulties, but also some of the promises of that new environment are occurring. I think the institutions that exist will have to confront that challenge and see if that help, if they can be facilitators of value adding in that context, or if they will become brakes upon it. Now, that's one aspect of that 4 point. The last aspect, so to wrap up of the four point is, you know, is there an issue? Are there lessons that can be learnt from the UK environment for developing countries? And I think there is, because I think one is, most countries now face this challenge of how you deal with an increasingly competitive international environment. And I suppose the lesson from the UK is, unless you put in a flexible, light-touch regulatory system for the internet sector, you are not going to get that basic innovation around low cost that is needed, and that Emily's chart, and I thought, you know, illustrated brilliantly the way it took off when the prices came down. And you can't do that if you have a rigid regulatory environment. And secondarily, that you will have to perhaps do that because that wave of that sort of IPv6 environment that is coming on, if we're too focused on the current internet environment and about getting control of that, we will put in place a system that won't be able to handle that ever environment that is already starting to emerge but is still fairly embryonic. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I must say I'm really impressed about this consensus between government and private sector in the UK. The best practice forums are meant to show the strengths of certain models, but also to show sort of potential weaknesses or challenges. So I hope that the audience will now challenge the panelists and ask critical questions regarding the presentations. Please introduce yourself.
John Carr from the...
Oh yeah, we need...
Always a help. John Carr from the UK's Children's Charities Coalition on Internet Safety. So to make one specific point, to perhaps disturb slightly this impression that's been gained of everything in the UK being sweetness and light and harmonious and that it always has been. It wasn't. I think today the regime that we've got, the self-regulatory regime that we've got within the UK as far as child protection is concerned, is one that we very much support and welcome. And I underline once again Alan Michael's point. I think it's true that we've achieved more in 2 years through cooperation than we would probably have done in 10 years had we gone the traditional legislative route. But it wasn't always like that. There were terrible rows between the internet industry and certainly the child protection lobby several years ago. I won't go into all of the details of them, but believe me, they were heated, they were deep, and they were serious. And I think it was only because the government essentially made it clear that they wanted the industry to move in a particular way that they did. In other words, it was self-regulation and light touch, but actually there was an iron fist inside that velvet glove. The industry knew that if they didn't reform themselves, the government would step in and make them change. And so they did change. And today it's a whole new environment, it's a completely different place, but I just want people to, I don't want people to go away with the idea that milk and honey flowed perpetually in Britain, because it didn't.
So much to the conditions of light touch regulatory approaches. Could I ask, there was another question, because I think we spoke enough for the time being. So actually we need somebody to hand over them the microphone.
Hello, my name is Miguel Pérez from the Spanish Internet Users Association. I have just a little bit question. Do you have any plan in UK to fight spam?
Anybody who wants to pick this one up?
Spam is a problem that we don't have a solution to. We'd have work on. One of the earliest pieces of public policy work that Lynx was involved with was in creating a best practice document addressed to internet service providers to describe certain practices that should not be done, should not be tolerated, so as to minimize the spamming that was going on. So we said things like, you shouldn't run open relays. You should just simply write it into your customer contracts that your customers aren't allowed to spam. Things like this, basic stuff. This was many years ago. Nowadays, the situation's moved on a bit. Spam isn't done by clueless marketing people who think, oh, the internet, that's great. I can send a free email. I can send it to everybody, and that'll be great. That's not where spam comes from nowadays. Nowadays, spam comes from organized crime. And so spam is not now, and dealing with spam isn't now a question of best practices on the part of ISPs and managing their customer relationships. Instead, it's an IT security issue. It's about preventing your machines being trojaned so that it can be taken over by organized crime for sending spam. So the situation's moved on over the years. But yes, we've certainly worked on the issue, and we continue to do so. IT security is a very specialist field of software development, and there's a whole industry now that is devoted to that.
I was going to say something on the spam issue. Merlin Errol, Lord Errol, House of Lords, and I was on the Science and Technology Committee that produced the report on personal internet safety just recently. And we looked at it, among other things, and so I thought I'd put forward our rather contentious thing that we did say about this, because a lot of the spam is originating from botnets, some of which are located in the UK, a lot of which aren't. And one of the things that we discovered was that several ISPs, though they knew of bots which were sitting on customers' computers, were not doing anything about it in case they lost their mere conduit protection. And so we actually put up a recommendation that they should be exempted from interfering in that case. It was misunderstood the way it was picked up by the Home Office there when they responded, thinking we were trying to remove the mere conduit protection. But we did think, though, that it should be removed if they didn't respond to finding a bot sitting on their thing, and that they should be allowed to proactively deal with it in some way in order to try and reduce the UK as being somewhere where bots could reside quite happily. So that was one thing that we did put up as a recommendation to try and help with spam.
Just to build on the other responses that have come through, what emerges is that spam there isn't a single brilliant solution to spam, but there are a layered approach of responses, whether that be from Netcraft's anti-phishing toolbar or proprietary anti-spam or blocking software. One element that we're interested in as the registry is a way of better securing the domain name system itself, and we have been putting a lot of resources into examining the emerging technology of DNSSEC, which I won't go into in detail, but just to highlight that this is one element. It won't cure everything, it won't do everything, but it could be a platform on which more secure applications can build.
Okay, thank you. My name is Amichiki Mwangi from the Kenya Internet Exchange Point. My question is more or less inclined towards the issue of spam, but more on internet security, to ask both to Malcolm and sorry, I can't remember the name. What efforts have you put in place to have CERT in the UK, a computer emergency response team, in that respect to looking at the greater aspects of internet security?
ISPs in the UK rely on a variety of CERT-type processors. We haven't found an enormous amount of value from a specialised UK CERT. So ISPs use CERTs operated by vendors, principally by router manufacturers and so forth. They're vendor advisories, and the US CERT, DEB, US CERT advisory list, things like BugTrack, another technical forum. There is software vulnerabilities that give rise to the potential to exploit it for spamming or for other illegitimate purposes are not really a national issue because the software isn't national. So there's no particular need for the, in our view, for the, in practice in the UK, for the CERT advisory to be particularly a national thing. Now, there are times when that may be slightly different, particularly when it comes to not advising the ISPs as to how they can protect themselves or major corporate users, but when it comes to popularizing the warning of a vulnerability to the mass general public. And at that point, essentially what you're talking about there is not so much an advisory, a technical advisory, but you're actually talking about a marketing and educational thing. And in that area, there has been work within the UK through things like Get Safe Online. Perhaps, Alan, you'd like to... No.
Just responding to the previous one and this, I mean, this is an instance where we actually think the UK government has powers that it's not effectively exercising in relation to spam. UK exists under the very same EU directive that the Spanish government does and every other EU government has done. It has not yet successfully prosecuted any spammer, as far as I know, in the UK, whereas other countries have. And we have consistently said that the government needs to give the Information Commissioner more effective powers, not new powers, but more effective powers to carry out investigations, close down fraudulent websites, etc. On the second issue about emergency response teams, I agree with what Malcolm said earlier, that spam's actually become an information security system issue now. And what, again, we feel that the government has not been able to, and it's not a criticism of any one department of government, it's also not a criticism of government overall in some damning sense, it's a challenging environment, but they have not been able to work out a system where it is simple for people when they experience breaches or attacks to report that to an authority that will decide what kind of response is required. And that is a requisite, we think, for an effective response.
Can I just say very simply, the answer to that is precisely the crime reduction partnership approach, not asking government to do it. You really, really don't want to ask the government to do it. What you really want to do is to ask the government to be a partner with industry and through the four-part accountability that I mentioned earlier to solve the problem, or to do as much as can be done to solve the problem.
Now we do see things like a hot potato being handed back and forth between private sector and governments. Not bad, huh? Now please go ahead.
Stephen Balkan with the Family Online Safety Institute. I want to play devil's advocate and just say, as much as I admire the UK model, and I've lived and worked there for many years, how exportable is it? Now, John made the example of the warfare that was going on just on the online safety field and the coming together. One of the reasons why it came together is that there is a tradition, a culture of nonprofits in the UK. Some go back 100 years, the children's charities and so on. Yet when we were in Mexico recently, or even a discussion yesterday with some Brazilians, it just isn't that same civil society, nonprofit, trade association, children's charity infrastructure to allow for whatever it is you end up calling self-regulation to happen. So as great as this example is, how exportable is it?
wants to pick up? I guess all of you, but you really need to keep it short now.
Very quickly, this session is not a sales pitch. We're not for a minute saying, everyone in the whole world do exactly as we do. What we're doing is sharing experiences of what's worked and what we have learnt through our mistakes sometimes. And it's just to encourage people to think and communicate, and it's a way that we have learnt very effectively with our industry partners.
Yes, I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, not everything about what we've done in the UK will have relevance elsewhere, but I think some of it does. I mean, when John was talking before, he was painting a much bleaker picture than I remember, in the child protection discussions, and certainly there were some, I mean, we're very proud of what we've done in the child protection area, but some of that is specific to the UK. It may not be that other, I know that there are some other European colleagues of ours that think we can get a bit hysterical about this one issue when there are much broader issues that need to be looked at, and some of it has been headline driven. It's true, it's political. Well, that's what you expect. But at the same time, I mean, certainly in the area that I was speaking to, the internet exchange points, as a model for a country that is having to do too much of its internet traffic internationally when it could be doing it locally, that I think is a model that can be exported. Indeed, it has been exported. We there are now 35 internet exchange points around Europe that are members of EURIX, the European trade body for that, and a substantial majority of them have explicitly adopted the Linksys model, including our constitution on that. Now, I would very much like to see this being discussed with other countries that are further afield than Europe, particularly those that are less developed in terms of and facing more problems on the cost of international interconnection charging. And I very much look forward to the workshop on this subject later in the week on internet exchange points in developing countries, because I really do think that there is something to be said there.
Thank you, Malcolm. We are running out of time. Perhaps we should now collect a few questions. Next one is you. I've seen you. So you don't answer directly. I'm collecting now, yes?
Thank you. I can be brief. I'm Heather Dryden from the Canadian Department of Industry. I wanted to ask a question about your decision to have a UK IGF. You're clearly pleased that you did it, and with its outcomes, you're presenting it as a best practice. But I'm wondering what exactly precipitated your decision to have one? What drove you to do that?
Thank you. Now you, please.
Hi, talking about exportability of best practice and from the UK, last year I was here, well, in Athens actually, we met Emily and we started something called the Domain Name Dispute Resolution Center in Pakistan, having heard what they do with dispute resolution. And we can say that it was interesting because previously in Pakistan people would go to court to get a stay order against a domain name. Now they can get arbitration. And this is working very, very well. It's excellent for the economic value of the CCTLD in Pakistan, and it's been a success story. So that has exported itself. It has been a success. My question is, I mean, all of these sort of best practices are there, and I think there's a lot that places like Pakistan, India, and others can learn from this, or common law jurisdictions. Has any concentration, and my question would be to the Right Honourable MP, been given to get DFID to start working programs on consultancies from the UK into these areas? Because we've tried to get access, but we haven't. But the private sector from Nominate has helped us out.
Okay, and then there was a last question somewhere. Yes.
Thank you. I'm Vikram Pisane, for part of South African government delegation, but I work as a general manager for the South Africa's top-level domain name manager. Just two quick questions. Noting that the UK IGF model is quite workable and a good example of what one can learn from, I just want to know, is there a clear agreement on what the forum will be doing in 5 years' time? Is there a charter, is there terms of reference between the partners as to what it should be doing years down the line? Two, is the future of this forum dependent on what is happening at IGF, or this forum will have maybe from time to time its own diversions where it deals with local issues that may not be on the issues of the IGF. For example, the issues of internet rights. You know, if this IGF decides not to prioritize that, would you differ, because maybe it's important in the UK, and focus on it? Thank you.
Okay, I think we now do a really quick wrap-up round, starting perhaps with Emily.
To wrap up, I think I'd like to address your question, Heather. Why did we think about doing a UK IGF? It's about walking the talk, and it's about trying to think about how to engage with this international process in a way that's relevant and set up two-way communication processes. I think too much in these international fora, we exist in our own rarefied atmosphere. We all see each other at meetings and we rarely talk to other people. So this was trying to get a way of listening to what people care about in our local area, and perhaps then starting to think about, rather than reacting, to proactively introduce perhaps elements on the agenda which are relevant to our people, and perhaps encourage other people to do the same, and that way to get more people into the tent discussing these issues.
Thank you, Malcolm.
I'll just say one thing, and that's picking up on the last gentleman's point about having a five-year plan. I hope not. Because if we had a five-year plan, that would imply that we thought that we knew now exactly what must be done, and exactly how to do it, and exactly what things are going to be like in 5 years' time, and I hope that's not true. I hope that we've got more imagination than that, and that by bringing people together and having these discussions of people that wouldn't have met each other otherwise, we can achieve things that we can't even imagine now.
Thank you.
On the first thing of what got us to the point of agreeing to set up a UK IGF, for me, this was the start of a journey when I was asked, when I left government, to chair a group on e-crime. Came rapidly to the conclusion that this, of all areas of activity, required a flexible, industry-led, engaged, but accountable system forward. You can't have interventions without some form of accountability. That's the what we have at the moment, which in some places is the law of the Wild West, rather than a proper and accountable system. But it also needed to be very flexible and fast. Therefore, in order to have that sort of system to deal with crime and nuisance on the internet, you have to have some form of engagement and governance. You have to have accountability and transparency. And therefore, the two ideas to me came together. As far as the UK IGF is concerned, exactly as Emily said, it means walking the talk and showing over the next year what it is that sort of approach involving the four partners can contribute into the international debate, instead of talking theoretically about what we wish the IGF would spend its time on. The second point, John referred to the battles that went on in getting child abuse on the agenda. And isn't it positive that we not only had the engagement of the NGOs, who met in a fascinating meeting last night, but had the Secretary General's message highlighting the protection of children as being an absolute key issue? What I would say is that the message is to industry, don't wait for it to be a battle which will either lead to bureaucratic and legislative responses or NGOs creating a public response. Why don't we anticipate what the problems are and be more flexible? The answer to the question, is it exportable? Yes, but it's exportable to the environment which exists in another country. We don't think that the UK environment is going to be what the situation is in America or anywhere else. But my point on the DFID question is that DFID does give quite a lot of support to development which is about governance issues. And for instance, organisations like the John Smith Memorial Trust, for instance, has been doing a lot of work with the development of NGOs in the former states of Eastern Europe. And that's the way to do it, to enable people to develop their type of NGO or civil society engagement, not to say it has to be exactly the same model as ours.
Thank you. Martin, please.
Thank you. I think the whole of the process is actually associated with developing a shared consensus, a common understanding, that sharing of knowledge and understanding of how one might be able to move issues forwards. And as such, I think that is eminently exportable. I don't think that is or should be a problem anywhere. And if it is, then, there's something very much more fundamental at stake. The issue of pulling in other organisations, I think what has happened in the UK is that organisations have become vociferous because there is a framework in which they can get involved, understand, and then you get people who are really driven by fire in their belly coming up with the ideas and the solutions. And the preparation for the IGF, I actually see as being a logical continuation of that process, that it allows us to move forward. And I fully agree with the comment. I would hate to say I know what I'll do in 5 years' time, because it really will depend on what are the issues that are coming up and how those issues could be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. And finally,
okay, Jeremy. Thank you. Yes, I mean, I think the key thing that is exportable is that it's got to be a partnership, and it's got to be a partnership based upon honest and open communication between the various partners. Who the partners are exactly, how it works, that's, you know, the term for each country, what the issues that they're dealing with. But it's also in that it does require, you know, government cannot tell business what to do, and business cannot just shirk responsibilities. But in that regard, it requires a lot of sort of internal reflection too. To be a good partner, you've got to improve your act. And so both government needs to get its competences more sharply defined, and same in the private sector. And, you know, I think every country is going to do that. It has to be an open process, because that environment in which that is occurring is changing so rapidly.
Thank you very much. The message I take home from this session is that you are all quite happy with the division of labor that you've developed over the years, but I also see some dynamics having to do with changing roles. You need to learn in a way. Businesses have to become more responsible for things they used to perhaps ignore because they regarded them as mere costs. Governments become a bit more laid back, perhaps. And there is also some negotiation occasionally on who is actually responsible for that, for what. And I think it's quite interesting to watch this. And for me, as a new citizen of London, I'm quite looking forward to that. So thank you to the audience for being so patient, and thank you for these interesting presentations and comments from the panel.